Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of UFOs and the Paranormal Over Our Heads. I'm your host, Preston Bennett, and each week we talk about UFOs and the paranormal, as the title suggests. And tonight, I am so excited. We have a really prestigious guest. Her name is Kathleen Marden, and she has written a book called Captured, The Betty and Barney Hill UFO Experience. And what makes this guest so interesting is she is actually Betty Hill's niece and has been studying not only Betty's case for many, many years, but also the entire subject of UFOs and has been very active in the UFO community. So that's what we're going to be talking about tonight. But before I introduce my guest, let me just give you a little bit of news of what's going on in the paranormal and UFO world. And there is some interesting stuff. I want to talk a little bit about microwaves, which isn't exactly paranormal, but it's sort of alternative health. And I've done a few shows on that. And I just think it's very interesting. This is an article that was published in August 6th, 2007. It was written by Mike Adams. And he is claiming, like many other people, that microwaves actually destroy the nutritional value of your food. And he is not just claiming this. Apparently, there are a number of studies which show that microwaving vegetables destroys up to 97% of the nutritional content of the vitamins and phytonutrients. Now, that's a lot. What he's saying is eating raw broccoli provides you with natural anti-cancer medicine that's extremely effective at halting the growth of cancer tumors, but microwaving that broccoli actually destroys the anti-cancer nutrients, rendering the food dead. Apparently, we are the only animals who destroy their nutritional value of the food before they eat it. And microwaves were apparently outlawed in Russia for a period of time. So we still are using microwaves, and there's been a lot of study on this. And it's a big controversy, and I don't think we've heard the end of it yet. But we will see. And what else do we got going on? Some interesting stuff. In London, apparently two German physicists have claimed to have broken the speed of light. This is an achievement that would, of course, undermine our entire understanding of space and time. Well, of course, depending on your perspective. I mean, I have heard of several UFO cases that do seem to involve time travel, which would indicate that it is possible. But these scientists, Dr. Gunter Nimtz and Dr. Alphonse Stauhofen of the University of Koblenz, say that they have actually breached a key tenet of Einstein's special theory of relativity, which states that it would take infinite amounts of energy to propel an object at more than the speed of light. Apparently, they have taken microwave photons and demonstrated that they have traveled instantaneously between a pair of prisms that have been moved up to 3 feet apart. Now, this is, of course, if true, would be a quantum leap, and it's not the first news we've heard of this sort of thing going on recently. So we'll see. Another piece of interesting news is the UFO watchtower in Colorado in the San Luis Valley. A lady has built this tall tower specifically for viewing UFOs in Colorado, in the San Luis Valley, which is, in fact, a UFO hotspot. I have been there, in fact, and I did see a UFO. Not at the watchtower. But what's really interesting is this watchtower, which is built by Judy Messaline, and this has actually drawn many, many people, and more than 15,000 people, in fact. And believe it or not, there have been several sightings from this actual watchtower. So it's a pretty interesting thing, and I think it's sort of a step forward the way we view UFOs. I mean, here's someone who's actually studying them in the field, which is how they should be studied, as opposed to armchair research. And we have a little bit of sad news. Reverend William Booth Gill has died. He was a witness to a 1959 UFO incident in Papua New Guinea, which is a classic case. He and many, many others at a large mission saw this UFO with occupants on top of it and actually waved to it. It was a three-day-long event, and it was an extremely well-known sighting. And it's unfortunate that William Gill has died at age 79, and we'll send him our blessings. Other than that, there's not a lot going on. The new MUFON Journal is out. It's got an article about the Star Child. This is a skull which has been discovered and studied by Lloyd Pye, which is proving to be very, very unusual indeed. Could be some actual physical proof of the UFO presence, which is really building into a really mountainous thing. At any rate, let's just get to our guest, because this show is going to be amazing. Our guest tonight is Kathleen Martin, and she is actually Betty Hill's niece. She was 13 years old, and her Aunt Betty actually called her home to report that they had seen a UFO the night before. Today, Kathleen is a social scientist and an educator. She has taught classes on UFOs for 10 years, served on the MUFON Board of Directors as the Director of Field Investigator Training. I think she actually graded my test. That's very possible. At any rate, she's been on numerous radio and television programs and has written articles for the MUFON Journal, and she is the co-author with Stanton Friedman, himself a very well-known UFO investigator, of the new book, Captured, The Betty and Barney Hill UFO Experience. And for those of you who don't know the Betty and Barney Hill story, I don't know where you have been living. It's probably the most famous case in UFO history, and it occurred on September 19th, 1961, in the White Mountains of New Hampshire, when Betty and Barney Hill were driving through the mountains when they encountered this UFO. And the story was originally told in John Fuller's book, The Interrupted Journey. But you know what? That was not the complete story. And there's been a lot of developments since then, some very, very interesting developments. And Kathleen Martin is the person to talk to about this, because not only is she Betty Hill's niece, she's had full access to Betty's estate, all of her papers, all of the hypnosis tapes. So this is going to be really interesting, and I'm just so excited to talk to her. Kathleen, thank you for coming onto the show.
And thank you for having me.
Wow, you know, I bet you never realized that this is going to draw you into sort of the whole UFO field. I mean, when Betty came in or called you that all those years ago to say she saw a UFO, I mean, who would have thought it would lead to this?
I had absolutely no idea. I don't think I had ever even heard of UFOs before that night.
Oh, really? So what did you think when that call came in?
Well, I was really amazed. My mother told me that Betty had told her that she had a close encounter with a UFO in the White Mountains, that it had descended to within about 100 feet of their vehicle. She told her about the lights on it. She told her that there was a double row of windows with a blue-white light shining from behind the windows, and there was a red light that telescoped each side of it on small bat-like wings, and that it had beeped their vehicle.
Wow, it's so unusual. I mean, was everyone believing this? I mean, was anyone skeptical at this point?
No one was skeptical. My Aunt Betty was a highly credible person.
Right, right. Well, so tell us about your Aunt Betty and about her life before this incident and who she was.
Well, she was a social worker for the state of New Hampshire. She had graduated from the University of New Hampshire after raising a family. She initially started college in 1937, but after 2 years of college, she dropped out and was married and adopted and raised three children.
Wow.
Subsequently, she was divorced and decided to go back to college and finish her education, and was working as a social worker for the state of New Hampshire. She was also involved in political activism and trying to improve the lives of many, many individuals.
Right. A really good witness. I mean, definitely a reputable person.
Yeah.
Wow. So, and Barney was, what about him? How did he get meet Betty?
Barney was from Philadelphia. He was actually born in Virginia, raised between Virginia and Philadelphia, had served in the Army during World War II, was married previously, had two sons, was very involved with his sons in Philadelphia, but had met Betty during a vacation in 1956. And after his divorce, they had developed a close relationship and were married in 1961. He worked for the U.S. Post Office, and he was also involved in the civil rights movement at that time.
So they were married, like, shortly before this incident, then?
They were married in 1960.
Oh, so like a year before.
Yes, May 12th, 1960.
Mm-hmm. And how old was Betty when this, in 1961?
She was 42 years old.
Okay. Wow. All right, so why don't you just lead us into what happened? I mean, this is really an amazing story. They were driving through the White Mountains that night. And
yes, they were actually returning home to Portsmouth, New Hampshire, on the seacoast from Montreal. They had spent a very pleasant day in Montreal. But Barney decided not to spend the night there. He decided just to travel on toward New Hampshire, and thinking that if he grew tired, he'd stop and at a motel or a cabin along the way, and they'd spend the night there. And as they were traveling south of Lancaster, New Hampshire, Betty spotted what she at first thought was a falling star, only it fell upward, or a satellite, was watching the road, so he didn't see it initially. But so Betty continued to watch it for the next several miles, and it seemed to be growing larger and larger and coming closer. And she decided that she wanted to ask Barney to stop the car so that she could take a look at this thing. And she told him, about 17 miles south of her initial sighting, that she wanted to stop and walk the dog. So he stopped the car, and this was her first opportunity to actually get out and view it through binoculars.
Right.
Well, she saw it travel across the face of the moon, flashing multicolored lights, and told Barney how unusual it was. He had finished walking the dog. He gave the dog to Betty and looked at it through binoculars. And it was traveling rapidly at that point in a northwest direction. And then suddenly, without seeming to turn, headed directly back in his direction. And it reminded him of a large aircraft coming in for a landing at that point.
Right. So, I mean, clearly this is not a star, a shooting star, or a satellite. For anyone to even raise that as a possibility.
No, it wasn't. It was very large. He said at that point he could actually see the windows in it, and it was completely silent.
Wow. And close enough to hear if it had been a craft.
Yes, certainly.
Wow. So he's looking at it through the binoculars, and this is when he started to feel fear, huh?
Well, he felt that he needed to report it to a police officer if he found one along the way at that point.
Oh, okay.
He returned to the car and started to drive south, soon entering Franconia Notch. And through the notch, this craft bounced along the top of the mountains. It descended behind the mountain or in front of the mountain, and finally at the southern end of Franconia Notch, it just descended to within about 1,000 feet of the couple. It was traveling in a stair-step type of pattern. It appeared to be spinning, and it was bouncing forward and becoming very large and then receding very rapidly.
Wow.
Into the distance. So it was sort of bouncing back and forth.
Now, Betty and Barney must have been talking about it at this point.
Oh, yes, they were, and Barney actually was driving very slowly at this point and stopping briefly to look at it from the windshield of his car from the driver's seat. And he stopped. He made one stop just south of the old man of the mountain and got a really good look at it at that point. Then he continued on, and he was going to stop again when he reached an area in Lincoln, New Hampshire, called the Indian Head area. He decided that he really wanted to get another good look at this thing. This was a couple of miles south of the Franconia Notch. It was an area where there were hotels and motels and a tourist attraction called Natureland. But, of course, it was the off-season, so there wasn't much business going on there. Before he could even find a place to pull to the side of the road, this craft shifted ahead and hovered about 100 feet above the vehicle, just to the right of the vehicle, on this U.S. Route 3 that they were traveling on. This was the major north-south highway through northern New Hampshire at that time. And he was forced to stop directly in the center of the road, straddling the line.
Wow.
He took the binoculars, opened the driver's side door, and stepped out, looked up, bracing his arms on the roof of the car, but his arms were jiggling from the vehicle's motion. So he stepped away. And as he stepped away, the craft shifted to the adjacent field. And it did this in a very smooth, gliding movement. He moved toward the field with his binoculars, looking at this craft, and both he and Betty observed a double row of windows and the red lights telescoping out of each end of the craft. And there were 8 to 11 individuals at the windows looking down at Barney.
Wow.
Suddenly, all at once, with military precision, all but one moved to a panel on the other side of the corridor in this craft, and their arms went up as if they were doing something. It reminded Barney of perhaps pulling levers. And this one that remained at the window started to communicate a very frightening message to Barney, while at the same time, the craft tipped in his direction, descended to within 50 feet of the ground, he estimated, and something started to drop out of the bottom of this.
Wow.
Now, the very frightening creature or being at the window was communicating the message to Barney that he should just stay there, don't be afraid, just keep those binoculars up to your eyes. That was Barney's thinking. Keep your arms up. He wanted to go for a gun that he had in his pocket, and he couldn't move his hand down to that gun. And he was beginning to lose the ability to control his own thoughts. So this frightened him very greatly, and he felt that he was about to be captured. Only he didn't know what they wanted to capture him for. And with all of the power that he could possibly gather, he pulled the binoculars down from his eyes, breaking the strap in the process, and ran screaming back to the car to Betty that he thought they were going to be captured.
Wow.
And as he was entering the car, he noticed that the craft had once again shifted from its position in the field and hovered directly above his vehicle. He put the car into first gear and started off down the road. He told Betty to roll down the window and look up so that she could see it. And just about that time, there was a series of what he called electronic or mechanical buzzing sounds. She referred to them as electric beeping sounds that seemed to bounce off the trunk of the vehicle. When she looked up, she couldn't see a craft there. She was expecting to see lights. She couldn't even see the sky. So apparently she realized later that the craft was directly above the car and that she was looking at the bottom of it.
Wow. See, this is fascinating. A lot. I didn't get this from John Fuller's book, not in this detail. So this is very interesting.
A lot of the hypnotic sessions, the testimony that Betty and Barney gave, were not included in the interrupted journey. So I learned a great deal of information from transcribing those hypnosis tapes.
I can imagine. Wow. I mean, this is, it's great that you've written this book. So, captured. Not, now, how can people get a hold of this book? If they want to get it, it's on Amazon.com.
It's on Amazon. It's in Barnes & Noble. It's at most bookstores. You can send a check for $18.99 to Kathleen Marden at P.O. Box 93, East Kingston, New Hampshire, 03827, and I will mail an autographed copy to you by priority mail, or you can go online to Stanton Friedman's website, which is stantonfriedman.com, and you can purchase the book for, it's an autographed copy, for $18.99, and use PayPal there.
Oh, okay, so, and I also want to let people know that if they'd like to call in, this is a call-in show. If you want to call in and ask Kathleen some questions, our number is 877-876-5227. Okay, Kathleen, sorry for the interruption.
Problem.
So they were driving along and they heard these beeps, and this is what always bothered me, the amnesia part of UFO abductions is something I never can fully wrap my mind around, but this is like the first real case of it.
Yes, I believe that it is. But subsequently, I have read about other cases of beeping on cars.
Yeah, it's not terribly common, though.
It's not terribly common, no.
Yeah, it's interesting. So that's when their amnesia actually started? You think that was the cause of it, was this beeping?
There's a good chance that it was the beeping, but Betty's amnesia was not as complete as Barney's. Barney's was fairly complete at that point, and he was just driving along, and Betty was continuing to look out. They were not speaking. She recalled seeing what she called a pumpkin head, and there is a jack-o'-lantern resort 8 miles south of that field. So one of our many trips up there, Betty told me that, you know, she thought that that's probably what she saw. Betty also remembered the wheels on the vehicle sort of squealing as they made a very sudden left-hand turn over a steel frame bridge. And then they were driving on a secondary road. It was actually State Highway 175. Headed south, and then they made a sudden left-hand turn after that. But I don't think that Betty actually consciously recalled that second left-hand turn. I think that at that point she thought that they were just lost, and they drove on. They finally found their way to Plymouth, which really wasn't very far down the road. And south of Plymouth, they heard a second series of buzzing sounds, and around the Ashland, Plymouth area. And 17 miles north of Concord, they again regained full consciousness and started speaking to each other.
Wow. Now, Barney also had some memory of like a roadblock, didn't he?
Yes, he did have, always retained, a conscious memory of a roadblock, and so did Betty. And they could never quite figure out what that involved or where that was. But it was very interesting that in the fall of 1963, actually before Barney's first session with Dr. Benjamin Simon, the psychiatrist who did the hypnosis.
Right.
My mother and father and I were attempting to assist Barney in recalling what had happened to him. And we were walking him through this moment-by-moment experience up to this roadblock. And suddenly, in a very strong release of emotion, he recalled the actual roadblock. And he recalled stopping in this road and that there were beings ahead, that they were walking in sort of an odd, sort of disjointed, rolling gait, and that their arms were in a downward swinging motion as if they were signaling him to stop.
Huh.
So he did remember that much.
Wow.
Prior to the hypnosis.
Well, I mean, right after the sighting, I mean, they returned home. They weren't even thinking of, you know, we've been captured at this point, right? They just thought they had a sighting.
They weren't thinking that, but they were very perplexed because the tops of Barney's best dress shoes were badly scraped. In fact, he had to wear them to do yard work after that. Betty's dress was torn. The hem was torn in one area, and this was a new dress. She'd worn it only once before, and the lining of the dress was torn out from the waist all the way down to the hemline, and her zipper was torn. There was a 2-inch tear on the top right side of her zipper, and a 1-inch tear in the actual zipper fabric on the left-hand side. So, you know, this was a very odd thing, but she folded the dress and placed it in her closet and just completely forgot about it until about 1964.
Wow.
Their watches were permanently destroyed, and there were also 12 to 18 highly polished spots on the trunk of their vehicle that were not weather spots. They were very different looking from weather spots. There were 12 to 18 of them. They were about the size of silver dollars. And when Betty and Barney placed a compass over the top of them, the compass would spin and spin, whereas when they moved it to other areas on the car, it would drop down or just fluctuate.
Well, so clearly their car was in some way manipulated.
It seems that way.
I mean, the physical evidence just stacks up and up. So at some point that they realize that this was not just a sighting, huh?
Yes. Yes, at some point, you know, you have to actually realize that something happened to them. And they were always aware of the fact that they were missing a little time, even accounting for the period of slow driving and the 3 stops that they made to observe the craft. But it wasn't until November 25th, 1961, when they were meeting with Robert Homan and C.D. Jackson to discuss their sighting, that they realized that it was a full, at least 2-hour period of missing time.
Well, that's not that much longer after the sighting. That's just 2 months, right?
So, that's correct.
So they were right in there investigating this thing from day one.
Yes, well, Walter Webb actually was there on October 21st, 1961, about a month later, and they reported their sighting to the Air Force as soon as they woke up after they arrived home and they'd spoken to my mother. The Air Force report actually says that the report was made on September 21st, but Betty always recalled phoning on the night of September 20th and then speaking with them again on the 21st and perhaps the 22nd, too.
Did she say how the Air Force reacted to her call? Were they interested?
They did seem very interested. Initially, Barney didn't even want to speak to them. He was really feeling very uneasy and embarrassed about the whole thing. But they did seem to take him seriously, and so he did speak to them. He, however, did not mention that he had actually seen beings on the craft. But he did mention the double row of windows, the lights, and that it was the size of a dinner plate at arm's length.
Well, so neither of them wanted any publicity at this point, right? Or
they did not. They, in fact, never really sought publicity about the whole thing. It was not until 1965 when a newspaper reporter for the Boston Herald Traveler got wind of the story and was assigned to write about the story that this was made public. Betty and Barney had told some friends, and they had actually spoken informally to the two-state UFO study group in November of 1963. But they wanted this information to remain confidential. They didn't want it to be made general knowledge to the general public. And actually, when John Luttrell was going to write those articles, he wanted to interview them. They refused, and they actually hired or had a consultation with a couple of lawyers in order to attempt to prevent him from writing these articles and publishing them, but they weren't able to stop him from doing so.
Boy, what did Betty think of all this growing publicity and to be in the center of this kind of a firestorm?
They were very apprehensive about this. They thought that they might lose their jobs, that they might lose their credibility in the community, and during this time they were becoming more and more involved in the civil rights movement. Barney was the chairman of the board of directors for the Rockingham County Community Action Program. That's an organization that they were founding members of. He was on the state advisory board for the Office of Economic Opportunity. He was a representative to the U.S. Civil Rights Commission for the state of New Hampshire. So they really had a lot to lose by having this be made public.
Right. So at one point, I mean, it was after they went under hypnosis. This is when they finally decided for sure that, you know, this has really happened and they've been captured.
Yes, it was after the hypnosis, and the hypnosis took place in the spring of 1964, but they kept the story under wraps for a long time and intended never to make it public. However, after John Luttrell wrote this series of articles, and they realized that they were not going to lose their jobs, in fact, the community was treating them pretty well, that John Fuller approached them. They decided that they would speak publicly for the first time at a church in Dover, New Hampshire, and they did not mention an abduction. They only mentioned their sighting. But John Fuller was there. He approached them and convinced them that they should allow him to write their story in a book.
Wow. So they agreed to it, huh?
So they, yes, after a very long period of negotiation, they agreed, and Dr. Simon joined in this venture.
Okay, so what exactly happened to Betty and Barney when they were taken on board? And I imagine you sat down with her and really went over this experience.
Yes, I did. In fact, you know, when I did this comparative analysis, taking sentence by sentence the transcription of the hypnosis tapes, I wanted to find out for myself if Betty and Barney had really been abducted.
Right.
You know, it would have been a lot easier for me to think that members of my family hadn't been, that maybe Barney had just absorbed Betty's dreams. So I wanted to compare what each said in order to find out if that hypothesis was true. And I found out that it was not true. That hypothesis would not hold water. And even though Betty and Barney were hypnotized separately, post-hypnotic amnesia was imposed, so even they couldn't remember what they said.
Right. Well, thank goodness that they had each other.
Yeah.
You know, some people go through this experience alone.
Right. And you know, the scenario played out very differently in many ways than it did in Betty's dreams. You know, I think that there was, that part of it probably was sort of a bleed through from her dreams into her hypnotic recall.
Right.
But not on Barney's part. So actually they were under hypnosis. The engine of their vehicle died. This group split into two. Three went to Barney's door. Three went to Betty's door. Two were behind those three that Betty observed. Barney closed his eyes. In Betty's dreams, they surrounded the car. They didn't split into two groups of three. In Betty's dreams, there were 8 to 11. They each said three went to each door. Betty counted two more, so there were maybe 8. But it was different from her dreams. In her dreams, they sat quietly and motionless. In hypnosis, Betty grasped the handle of the door. She was scared to death. She was crying. She was trying to escape. And they walked up to the door. She told me in her conscious memory that the one who opened the door was holding something in his hand, and that all of a sudden she lost consciousness at that point. And in hypnosis, she's talking about it, and she says, you know, he reached out to grab her, and then she said, and then I don't know what happened. So you can see at that point she lost consciousness. On the other hand, consciously remembered that they had removed, well, under hypnosis, remembered they'd removed the gun from his pocket, and that he had placed one foot on the ground, and that they had removed him from the car, that his arms were in an upright position, not down to his sides, and that they were assisting him, and that he could feel the toes of his shoes bumping along the rocks.
Right. And this is how his shoes got scuffed.
Pardon
presumably.
Me?
This is how his shoes got scuffed, presumably.
Yes, this is how his shoes were scuffed. When he was taken up the ramp to the craft, he could also feel his shoes bump over a little elevated area in the doorway at the entrance to the craft.
Wow.
Betty consciously remembered fighting for her life outside of the craft. She had woken up again and was resisting their attempts to take her on board the craft. And at that point, they rendered her helpless to resist again and took her on board. And, of course, they took them to separate examining rooms. Betty was seated in a chair with a headrest. Barney was taken immediately to a table. And they were both given physical examinations on board, somewhat unusual physical examinations. They both felt a light scraping on their skin. Their eyes were looked into. Their samples were taken from their ears, from their mouths.
Was she scared at this point? I mean, they're being kidnapped, captured. Did she ever say that these ETs were, like, evil, or were they just neutral, or how did she look upon them?
It's interesting that Betty and Barney each had their own individual response, subjective kind of response to these beings. initially, Betty was scared to death. There was one who was supervising this whole thing, standing in the hallway, who was extremely frightening and hostile appearing. And because they did harm Betty when they inserted a needle into her navel. But the leader at that point took the pain away, even though under hypnosis, the pain continued on for a couple of minutes. In her dreams, it didn't. But under hypnosis, it did continue on. And actually, she was so traumatized at this point, Dr. Simon decided to end the hypnosis session early. But it was at this point that Betty had a positive response to this leader, because he had taken her pain away, and she lost a lot of her fear. Mm-hmm. Barney, on the other hand, thought that they cared very little about him, and he actually made the statement that he thought if they had accidentally severed his arm, they would have just discarded it.
Wow. Wow.
So we can see that they each reacted differently.
Right. Well, I remember Betty in an interview, she once said that this incident was the first thing she thought about when she woke up, the last thing she thought about when she went to bed, and she had never felt more frightened in her life than when they were walking towards the car.
Right. She told me that, too.
Wow. Well, this incident pretty much defined a lot of her life, both Betty and Barney, huh?
It did. It really did. Thereafter, it became a very important part of their lives, and even when Betty retired in 1975, she devoted the remainder of her life to UFO research and investigation.
Barney, it seems, never really did a lot of publicity about this.
Well, Barney died in 1969.
Right.
So he died fairly early on in this whole thing.
I can't even remember seeing it. Any interviews at all where he describes what happened? Or?
He actually did do some interviews. He was on television, and he did some radio interviews as well. I have some of the archival tapes.
Wow. So, a lot of people report being abducted more than once. So, did Betty have any childhood experiences with UFOs or anything? Because, seems to be a pattern in a lot of cases of abduction.
It does seem to be a pattern, and Betty denied during her entire lifetime that she had ever been abducted more than once.
Wow. Well, that's entirely possible, because that's true in a lot of other cases. Not everyone has the same pattern turning up. But didn't she have some sightings afterwards?
She did, and when you read the book, you'll find that there is information to suggest that she may have been abducted more than once, but perhaps she didn't remember this, or perhaps she simply didn't want to remember this or even entertain the idea that it might have happened. But she did have additional sightings. In fact, she and Barney agreed to take part in a scientific experiment in order to attempt to contact these beings. And for about a period of 3 years, Betty relayed messages, both psychic and verbal, from the back porch of her home. And I don't know why it was done from the back porch of her home. Scientist gave her the script that she needed to read in order to attempt to vector in UFOs. So I write about that in two chapters in the book, actually, and it's a pretty interesting series of experiments, and there's some circumstantial evidence that she may have actually brought some in, but it was not something that they could prove scientifically, because it might have been a coincidence.
Wow. Well, I don't know. There seems to me a lot of cases where people have done precisely that.
Yes.
also, as unusual as it may sound, these ETs, apparently that's how they communicate.
Apparently.
So, I just spoke with someone recently who told me of a sighting which occurred just last week up here in California in Palmdale, where a young couple was driven up to the top of a mountain, and they were just watching the stars, and the light came swooping down and was moving actually through the trees. And the girlfriend, she became very frightened, and she thought, she actually spoke out loud, "You're scaring us. You know, move away. You're scaring us." And it did. It moved away. So these things are monitoring people, clearly.
Certainly seems that way.
So what inspired you to write this book? I mean, this captured.
Well, I've always enjoyed writing, and a number of people had asked Betty if they could write her biography. And I always wanted to write Betty's biography. So the two of us, starting back in the early 1990s, decided that we would make this a project. And so we started to work together to supply me with all of the information for her biography. But it really ended up turning into a UFO book, and I guess it couldn't be any other way, given that it was Betty Hill's biography. And
I really enjoyed the fact that you gave background on both Betty and Barney, and it really kind of helped to understand the story even better.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, the book was, it's amazing, and you just don't know the Betty and Barney Hill story until you read this book.
Right.
I mean, the whole Air Force side of it as well, I mean.
They had many, many friends in the Air Force. It's amazing how many contacts they had with people in the military.
Yeah, that I thought was fascinating, and these people were very helpful with them, trying to figure out what happened.
Yes.
Wow. It's really a fascinating story. So what did Betty say about this star map? What did it look like? And did she, that was a huge part of this whole experience.
Yes, it was. It was about, it was rectangular, about 2 feet by 3 feet. The leader somehow manipulated the wall, and the star map appeared. It appeared to be perhaps a holographic image, and there were circles on the star map that she recalled, and some were connected by solid lines, and there were many solid lines. Others were connected by dotted lines or broken lines.
This is a holographic map?
Pardon me?
This was a holographic map, you said?
Yes, that's later. She and Marjorie Fish, who did the research, talked about it. Betty's description reminded Marjorie of a hologram.
Oh, really?
Yes, because it seemed it appeared to be three-dimensional. It wasn't like a paper map where it was drawn. It was almost as if she were actually looking at this. And Marjorie Fish actually started building models of our galaxy, attempting to locate what Betty had drawn. Dr. Simon had given Betty the post-hypnotic suggestion that if she felt that she could draw the map accurately and it wouldn't trouble her too much, that she could draw it, and she actually did. And so then Marjorie saw it in The Interrupted Journey and started her research. She was a member of Mensa, amateur astronomer, a school teacher, and she worked for quite a long time constructing these models based upon information that she was gathering from libraries and from the Gleasy catalog.
Boy, and she must have had a lot of patience.
Very,
an
incredible amount of patience. And she did this very methodically. She was looking only for stars that were a certain type that might have planets around them and that might be the right type of stars where the planets could have developed possibly intelligent life. So she was looking for habitable planets.
Wow. Very, very interesting. And also this, about the book, you know, that part of her experience fascinates me, where she was given the book by the leader and almost got to take it home. And I believe in that part of the experience, because I've heard of that in other cases, such as Betty Andreasen and others, where people have been given these books to look at for just a short period of time, usually, but sometimes they actually do get to take them home.
Mm-hmm. I didn't know that anyone had ever taken one home.
Yeah, Betty Andreasen actually held one in her home for about 2 weeks.
That's right, too. I recall that, and then it disappeared.
Right.
Yes.
But not before someone else saw it. Her daughter, I believe, actually saw it as well.
Mm-hmm.
So what did Betty say that this book was like?
Well, it was about 6 inches by 9 inches. It was made of thin, stiff, shiny plastic. There was print that seemed to be within the plastic itself. It had a dark cover, and that was stiff but not thick. There were six columns of this alien writing that seemed to be written vertically. And she actually, it's in the book, she, in the year 2000, recalling from memory what she could, drew what she thought she remembered. Her memory was pretty fuzzy at that point. It had certainly been a lot of years. But I asked her if she could possibly put something on paper from memory. So I can't say that this is entirely accurate.
Right.
She did write one row based upon her memory. She remembered dots, and she remembered slanted lines, that sort of thing. And it's actually in the appendix of the book.
Right. I'm looking at it. It's very interesting. It reminds me of some of the other writing that other people have reproduced, and, you know, the symbols,
mm-hmm.
like that other abductees have seen on board these craft, which, you know, have been matched up from case to case. I don't know about Betty's case, but some of these have actually provided corroboration.
Mm-hmm.
So it's very interesting. God, this case would have been so different if she had gotten to keep that book.
It certainly would have been.
Can you imagine?
Would have been the proof.
Right. But that didn't happen because the other people apparently didn't want, the leader was ready to give it to her.
The leader was ready to give it to her, but it was that nasty little guy who was out in the hallway who was supervising her examination, who in this mumbling or humming, screeching kind of sound, she said at that point, was talking with the other crew members in their own language and went over and spoke to the leader in their own language, and then he turned to Betty and took the book away and said that they had decided she couldn't have it. It would be best that she didn't remember the experience at all.
Well, but she did remember.
But she said if it was the last thing she ever did, she'd remember, and she eventually did.
Right, that's why she actually argued with them. That's interesting.
Yeah, she remained behind. It's funny, in her dreams, she and Barney were both escorted back to the car where they stood and watched the craft leave. But under hypnosis, each said that Betty remained behind, arguing with these this crew, while Barney was escorted to the car and sat in the driver's seat. He actually sat on his gun when he sat down. And then Betty came down the path a little while later, not long after that. In Betty's dream, the dog was underneath the seat of the car, and Barney actually said the dog was under the seat of the car, but by the time Betty arrived at the car, the dog was on top of the seat. And so at that point, she told Barney to get out of the car and watch the craft leave. So what each individual said under hypnosis was entirely different from Betty's dream recall.
Wow. Well, there you go. I mean, geez. So, did Betty ever say that she would like to go on board again after, you know, she recalled this and went through all this publicity? Did she want to go back on board?
No, she didn't. She could never overcome her fear of these UFOs. And even in the mid-70s, Dr. James Harder, who was the director of research for APRO, hypnotized Betty. They had a close relationship back then. And he was attempting to help her to overcome her fear of all of this. But she remained frightened for the rest of her life.
Poor thing, wow. That's a pretty traumatic experience, especially if you're like a pioneer in this and you have no one to turn to.
Yes.
You know, there's no one else who's reported this experience before her.
That's correct.
Wow. Well, she must have been pretty feisty to, you know, pioneered this and argued with the ETs. And
she was a feisty person.
Wow.
In a good way.
Right, right. Wow. Well, you've been listening to UFOs and the Paranormal Over Our Heads. I'm your host, Preston Denon. Our guest tonight is Kathleen Marden, and we're talking about her book, Captured, The Betty and Barney Hill UFO Experience, which she co-authored with Stanton Friedman. And Stanton's actually going to be on the show next week, so we're going to continue to talk about this and some of his research. But we've only got a few minutes left, Kathleen.
Okay.
Is there anything that we haven't covered? I mean, what do you think people should know about this, you know, Betty's experiences and about UFOs in general? I mean, you've been researching this topic for a long, long time.
Yes, I have been. And now, obviously, Betty and Barney were not intentionally harmed by these beings on board this craft. So I don't think that they have any type of malevolent agenda in mind.
Right. I agree with that. I mean, I don't see any evidence of not to, like, torture or, you know, them harming people on purpose for fun. Or...
Mm-hmm. And they were considerate enough to wipe out Betty's and Barney's memories, and certainly they did a sloppy job as being one of their first abductions. They've certainly improved their techniques over the years, but I think that it was very kind of them to attempt to prevent Betty and Barney from remembering what had happened to them. It was such a frightening experience.
Right. But did you know that there's a guy in South Carolina who says he was abducted by the same ETs, or that the ETs told him that they had abducted a couple in the White Mountains in 1961 and blah, blah, blah?
In South Carolina?
Yeah.
Recently.
No, not recently. It's a while back. His name is Bill Herman, I believe.
Oh, yes, yes. I've heard of that. Mm-hmm.
So it's interesting. I don't know if that's true, but you rarely get, like, the same ETs showing up in different cases. It seems like there's just so many different types of ETs doing this.
I know of another case, too, where a person was abducted, I believe, he and his son, together, and Betty and Barney's, I guess their name was invoked during that abduction, and he actually came out to visit Betty after that had happened and spoke to her.
Wow.
So, you know, apparently...
these ETs are getting around.
Same ones have abducted other people as well. Something else I wanted to mention is that dress that Betty was wearing on the night of the abduction has undergone chemical analysis.
Right.
And a chapter in the book is devoted to the chemical analysis of the dress. And I thought that was pretty interesting. That's just another piece of evidence that it was more than just a sighting.
Right. Oh, the preponderance of evidence totally, in my mind,
mm-hmm.
proves that this case took place exactly as, you know, they described under hypnosis. Well, not exactly, but you know what I'm saying.
I think.
Well, Kathleen, our hour is up. I want to thank you so much for coming on to the show. You've been an amazing guest.
Well, thank you for having me. I enjoyed it.
All right, well, I hope everyone goes out and buys your book. I'm going to just give the title again. It's called Captured, The Betty and Barney Hill UFO Experience. And next week, our guest will be Stanton Friedman, and we're going to talk more about the book and some of the science of the star map and the Air Force and Stanton's research into cover-ups and things like this. So it should be a lot of fun.
Sounds like a good show.
Thank you all for listening. You've been listening to UFOs and the Paranormal Over Our Heads. Our guest tonight has been Kathleen Marden, who's co-authored a book, Captured, The Betty and Barney Hill UFO Experience. Kathleen Marden is, by the way, Betty Hill's niece, the perfect person to write this book, and did an excellent job. I've read the book, and I very much enjoyed it. It finally tells what really happened in probably the world's most famous UFO experience. I hope you can all join us next week when our guest is Stanton Friedman. And until then, have a great evening.